Well, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. How are you all? Yes, good? As you take your seats, I would like to offer you some thoughts that I neglected to offer you yesterday to try to place the stories and the ideas that I'm exploring this week in context. This week, not as a minister, but as a storyteller, children's author, and recording artist, and practicing mythologist, I'm attempting to explore five topics. Yesterday was, does an afterlife exist? And during our talk back yesterday afternoon, we had a fantastic deeper exploration of that idea. And then today is by far the most difficult of all the topics. And yet, I thought that in the presence of a famously reflective community, it would be worth doing. The question is, does evil exist? And then tomorrow, we will move on to explore the nature of beauty, give ourselves some relief. And then, on Thursday, I'd like to take a look at language, how language either illuminates or completely distorts what it is that we're trying to learn from one another. And then finally, on Friday, I'm going to explore the thorniest of all the philosophical topics that I could find, and that is, do we indeed have free will? Or is all this simply a determined set of swirling, chaotic clockworks? And we are just whirling our way through it. And I invite you each afternoon to come at 3:15 to the recital hall to further explore these ideas. But here's the question then, since today's topic is, does this thing called evil exist? Evil is an old word that derives from Old High German and English, and it means transgression. So already you have a sense that some rule or set of rules are being transgressed in the commission of it. It's a difficult topic. It's fraught with fear. It's fraught with pain. And there seems to be, in the world today, a ready supply of it. As far as you look, whether it's wars, which you could put into the category of what philosophers and theologians call moral evil, or whether it is the tsunami that swept the Indian Ocean Basin in 2005 and took over 200,000 lives, which could be categorized as the other sort of evil that is natural evil. Death that comes from inexplicable places that has to do with the powers of nature. Whether it's one of those two, each of us in our lives will encounter it. It's impossible not to encounter it. And the question is, does it come from we human beings ourselves? And I'd like you to ask yourself this question. If you had two choices, which would you consider to be the closest to the truth? Have we invented it? Or is it indeed an all-permeating supernatural truth? I'll begin with a story that places itself somewhere between those two answers, by way of hedging. This is an old tale, pardon me, from Sweden. Swedish farmer stood on his new farm. Right near where he stood rose his barn. Close to that, the cow shed where the cows slept at night. And near that, his new hut. Now, you would have thought that a poor farmer, having just been given a farm, would have been a happy man. But no, this farmer's heart was filled with fear and woe and worry. because the farm he had just been commanded to work by the lord of the manor, who owned all the little farms, had an evil about it. As soon as you went out into the apple orchards in September to pick apples, they would shrivel up and fall to the ground beneath the boughs, rotten before they even hit. They were inedible. The cows would groan and low in the cow shed, and into the buckets would squirt sour milk. The fields would grow a rust, and the wheat would die away to the earth. No grain could be found anywhere you walked upon this unhappy farm. And the pigs, no matter how much you slopped them, could not grow fat enough to give any pork or ham or bacon. 100 families had tried to survive a harvest in a winter there in 100 years, but that this farm would give no food had driven all of them away. So you can imagine when this farmer was told he was the 101st with his wife and 2 young children to go work upon the evil farm. He was worried. But he was a good-hearted fellow, and so he talked to it that summer day. No one was looking. Sometimes you talk to places when no one's looking. And he said,
well, there, farm, I hope that you don't do this to me and my family like you did to all the other farmers who lived here. I've done nothing to you, farm. Never have I been here in all my life.
And suddenly he heard something. The farmer jumped up. Hello, hello, who said that? Hello, and he spun around and looked. But there was no one there.
What kind of a farm is this? Well, whoever you are, whatever you are, if I'm still alive in the spring, you can come calling.
Well, for some reason, that autumn's harvest wasn't completely lost. Why, there was one tree that dropped a few fresh apples. Off in the western side of his fields, a small corner of his grain crops gave forth some seed. They milled it away. They had a sack of flour for the long winter that was to come. Oh, one of the cows gave a few buckets of fresh milk, just a few. The farmer's wife was able to put away some cheeses, put away some cream. And there, one of the pigs actually grew fat enough for slaughter. And it looked as if they didn't eat too much each night, the farmer and his wife and his 2 young children would have enough food. And winter came. But safe inside, with just enough to eat each night, he knew he would probably survive the long winter. And since he needed them sorely, his old boots wrapped in rags, his wife went into the cobbler and had her husband made a new pair of boots. They were the only things he owned. And they were beautiful. There was not a smudge upon them. No manure, no mud, no scratches. And he said, oh, these are the most beautiful things I've had in my whole life. And he decided he wouldn't wear them outside in the mud. He continued to wrap his old boots in the rags, and each night, just before supper, he would push his new ones up close to the fire, and the one joy he had was to watch them twinkle. Well, winter passed, and the world outside his door turned to mud. He threw great planks of oak across the oozing mud of his barnyard, and all seemed ordinary until one spring night, as he and his wife and 2 children were about to have their supper, and suddenly the door blew open and slammed against the wall, and the children jumped up, and they ran and they hid behind their mother's skirt, for there, standing in the door, was a little man. He was about 1 foot tall. He was about 1 foot wide. And he walked in and he said, well, how do you do? How do you do? Here I am. Come like you invited me. And here I am. The farmer looked at him.
Yeah, here you are. Who are you?
Who am I? Who am I? I'm the elf of your farm. Who do you think I am?
Oh. Of course you are.
Well, come in. It's cold outside. Come in. And the little man pointed to the door and it shut by itself. You're the first farmer to invite me up here in 100 years. And I've got something for you. But first, I'm hungry.
The farmer looked around.
Oh, that's very lucky. For about to have supper, would you like to stay for supper?
Yes. And the little man jumped up onto the bench and began to look at all the food and said, now, what's that there? What's that right there?
Oh, that's the boiled pork. Yeah, you want some of the boiled pork?
Thank you very much. The little man took the entire piece for the whole family's supper and
shoved it into his mouth.
Aye, he's a hungry little man. My love, do we have any more of that pork?
No,
no, no, no, oh no.
But by then the little man had stood further down the bench and said, and what's that there? What's that?
Oh, that's the loaf of bread for the whole family. You want some?
I thank you very much. And the little man slid the entire loaf into his mouth.
He's a very hungry little man. My love, do we have any more of that bread?
No, no, no. What are we going to eat? I don't know. And suddenly the little man shot toward the door. And the door flung open. And out into the barnyard, the little man flew. The farmer ran to the door and could see him flying this way and that above the ground. And the farmer was made fearful, and the little man floated up and said, well, now come with me. I've got something for you.
Oh, no, oh, no. Where are we going?
We're going to my cave.
And suddenly the farmer realized it was his farm's elf. Mortals never saw them. And yet each Swedish farmer believed that beneath his farmstead one dwelt, a small person of supernatural origin who came up at night, moved hay about the barn, and made things grow. And this apparently was his.
Yeah, we're going to your cave. Oh, no, I'm coming then.
He looked down and realized, though, he was wearing his supper boots.
Oh, oh, hey, little man, wait a moment. I'm wearing my supper boots. It's muddy out in there.
He had thrown those oaken planks across the ooze of the barnyard and didn't want to sully his perfect boots.
No. Come now, farmer, come now.
Oh, no, you don't understand. These are my supper boots. I don't want to go out to get the manure on them.
This is more important than your boots. But now, farmer.
Yeah, I'm coming then. Oh, no. Goodbye, my love. I hope I come back.
Yeah. I'm coming. And the man ran out and followed the little man who was shooting across the various planks, headed for somewhere. And the farmer looked and saw him moving until finally he saw that the elf had stopped, hovering right at the doors to the cow shed where the cows slept at night. And the farmer in dismay could see billowing out into the spring night air great clouds of manure steam.
He looked at his boots.
Oh, no. Oh, little man. You don't want to go in there, do you?
In here, this way.
And the little man floated into the cow shed.
Oh, no, but... Goodbye.
Oh, no. Well, that was a fresh one, that one. And very unhappily, he followed the little man between the rumps of the cows until he saw that he had stopped, hovering above a suspicious-looking hole in the mud.
Here we are, farmer. Here's the door to my cave.
I don't think I can fit down that door. Even you...
No. It's a magic door. You put your toe in it.
And the little man put his toe near the hole in the mud and promptly vanished.
Aye. Are you down there? You're down there. I'm coming then.
And down he flew. And to his surprise, he found himself in a tiny cave. Little roots hung from the ceiling just above his head. He had to crouch. A fire crackled away suspiciously. Oddly, it made no smoke. And there was a little table, a tiny chair, cups and plates. And standing in the midst of it was the strange little man who said, "Well there, farmer, welcome to my cave."
"Yeah, thank you very much. You know, I never knew this cave was here, right under the cows."
"No, no, no one else does either. You sit there, I've got something for you."
"What's that?"
"Close your eyes. Put out your hands."
"I don't want to do that."
"Close your eyes and put out your hands."
"Yeah, I'll do that."
The man closed his eyes and put out his hands, and he felt something warm in a bowl placed in them. He opened his eyes and he looked. It was a bowl of porridge. He looked at it.
"Porridge? This is what you had for me?"
"Do you like porridge?"
"My favorite." "Well, you ate my supper." "I'll eat your porridge. Do you have a spoon?"
And the little man gave him a strangely curved wooden spoon, and the farmer was just about to dip the spoon into the porridge. He was indeed hungry when something dropped into it.
"Oh, no, what was that? What is that? Something dripping in here. What is that?
It's dripping from the roots up in the ceiling. Up in..."
"Oh, what is that? Oh, no. Oh, yes. Now, little man, you've got manure dripping from your ceiling. Don't you know that?"
The little man looked at him and said, "That's right, farmer. Manure dripping from me ceiling. Dripping on me table, dripping on me bread. And if I'm not careful, when I walk in here, it drips on me head. Now, you listen to me. I've been living in this cave for 853 years, longer than you'll ever live. And I took good care of that farm up above. And I loved it dearly. Until 100 years ago, a farmer came along and built the new cowshed right above my cave. Ever since, it's been drip, 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 drip. I don't like it. I've been blighting the crops. I've been making the cattle go sour because I don't like manure in me porridge."
The farmer just looked at the angry little man and said, "Oh, that's a sad story. Wait a moment. Maybe this something. Little man, you know, up there, that's my farm. I can put things where I want on my farm. What if, as soon as the mud dries, yeah, I move it away, clean it all up. I'll rebuild the cow shed off in the west field. I clean up all the manure. So no longer come drip, drip, drip in your home anymore. Would that make this evil thing that's been here go away? That make you happy?"
The little man looked at him. "Deal."
"Oh, deal. I promise. Soon as the mud dries, may I go and tell my wife? She's been so worried since we come here. May I go?"
"Yeah, you may go."
"How do I go?"
"Up there on the ladder over there."
"Yeah, I'm going to go, little man."
"Just go, farmer."
"Yeah, goodbye." And the man put his foot on the ladder and...
he landed, luckily, feet down between the cows. But he didn't care about his boots anymore, and he went running across the barnyard. He slipped, he fell, he laughed, he picked himself up, and he dashed inside and told his wife the good news. And true to his word, he moved the cow shed as soon as the mud dried. And from that day onward, if he went out into his apple orchards in September, they would swell up, the apples would grow glossy and fall to your hands. pigs. The pigs were the best in the district. The cows gave bucket upon bucket, half of which was cream, some of which churned itself to butter. And the fields were like gold. So if you're ever in a new place, doesn't matter if there's never been a place there before, you might remember to say hello to the earth it sits on, whether you think it's an evil spot or not, because you never know who might have been there before you and what they've had to endure in a story that you never heard. Thank you. All right, thank you very much. So there's a curious old story. Now, have you had time to reflect upon that question I posed before telling it? It's nice, it has a happy ending. Just as often, it wouldn't. I debated which story to share with you this morning. I had another terrifying story from the serfs of Russia about a lay priest of the Russian Orthodox Church who extorts a treasure trove of found gold from an old man whose wife has just died. And then the man, in order to extort it, dons the skin of the devil with horns and a goat skin, appears at the old man's window and terrifies him so much that the old man throws the gold out into the mud and shivers beneath his bed. And then the unscrupulous priest runs back, asks his wife to cut off the disguise she has so sweetly sewn upon him, and it will not come off. And it never does. But I thought I wouldn't tell you that story. No, instead, this one seemed to fill the bill better. It's a difficult set of notions to contemplate. It makes us very uncomfortable because we human beings, we are the ones who bear the brunt of whatever misfortunes, you can call it fortuna, bad fortune, good fortune, if you're an old Roman, or you can call it the work of Satan, the devil, Beelzebub, Baal, old scratch. On the other side of the divide of looking at whether events that happen to us be that are unfortunate for us are derived from that all-permeating supernatural truth that is reality, or whether it's our interpretation of misfortunes. And if you look at the East-West divide spiritually, you'll see that in the Judeo-Christian Islamic side of things, there's one way to look at it. If you look at the Eastern religions, there's a wholly different way, or the old pagan religions as well. Have you ever seen one of those great shows on TV where in part of the early credits you'll see blind justice? She holds a sword in one hand. She's a robed Grecian or Roman goddess, and she holds the scales in the other hand. You know, luckily, you know, if nowadays, if you were, you know, sort of in Miami, you might think that she was weighing cocaine and stay away from me, but no, she is Fortuna, who is the ancient Roman goddess of justice. If you've ever heard, in fact, I imagine that you're familiar with Karl Orff's Carmina Burana. Ah, yes, O Fortuna, velet luna, O fortune, like the moon waxing and waning, oh, please smile upon me, life sometimes is so filled with beauty, life sometimes is so oppressive and frightening. And these old songs were sung, derived from the Roman goddess Fortuna. There's a modern television show, Wheel of Fortune. Many of the beautiful circular windows in the cathedrals of medieval Europe were fashioned upon the four quadrants of the ancient Wheel of Fortune. And the Wheel of Fortune, much like the riddle of the Sphinx, what walks on four legs in the morning, two legs in the afternoon, three legs at night, you know, and the answer, of course, is a human being, on all fours as a baby, upright, and then with a cane in one's latter years. Famous riddle of the Sphinx, posed and only figured out by Oedipus, who we'll get to later in the week. And on the quadrant of the Wheel of Fortune, there is, you know, it's more of a sense of conquest. I've come, I have arrived, I am the king, I was once the king. Very interesting. A way to look at good fortune versus bad fortune. I want to read you something. Here's a very frightening topic. And this is one of the more explicable topics when dealing with the notion of does evil exist? And that is it psychiatric mismanagement or lesions upon the brain in various places, or is it demonic possession? It's one of the root, most frightening aspects of the world. And there are a great many legitimate people on both sides of the argument, and they will say, oh no, I'm very sorry, but this is absolutely real. And some people who didn't believe in it are caused to believe in it when they witness it. This is the Lutheran Church's description of possession. One, the knowledge of secret things, for example, being able to predict the future, find lost people or things, or know complex things that one has never learned. It is said that fortune tellers often ask a spirit for help, and that this spirit gives them certain powers. In that case, the evil spirit is assisting, not necessarily possessing, the person bodily. Two, the knowledge of languages one has never learned. Just as the devil can bind one's tongue, it is reported from the early church as well as the time of the Reformation that certain demon-possessed people could speak languages they had never learned. Three, supernatural strength. Far beyond what they previously had or should have, considering their sex and size, much caution in judging demon possession is required. All the circumstances and symptoms must be taken into consideration. Insanity should not be confused with possession. On the other hand, possession may be taking place even when these symptoms are absent. Yikes! You're all out there, I can see you. Just because you don't have those symptoms, it doesn't mean a thing. On the other side of the analysis, we find this. This is from Wikipedia, which I submit to you is an increasingly legitimate source. Those who profess a belief in demonic possession have sometimes ascribed the symptoms associated with mental illnesses, such as hysteria, mania, psychosis, Tourette's syndrome, epilepsy, schizophrenia, or dissociative identity disorder. In cases of dissociative identity disorder, in which the alter personality is questioned as to its identity, 29% are reported to identify themselves as demons. I do not know the answer to that question, but it is a most unsettling field of inquiry. And if evil derives from the word transgression, then there is an accepted set of rules that, of course, must be transgressed in order to commit it. One of the most, and I'll share this with you, I hope you don't mind, one of the most unsettling things but that I have witnessed over the last 2 years in my researches has been a video that came from Afghanistan. You're all familiar with the fate of the reporter, Mr. Pearl. And you're all, I'm sure, aware of the struggle of belief systems that is going on clothed in these wars in the Middle East. And whether it is for oil, or whether it was a complete blunder on the part of the Bush administration, whether it's part of a global mapping of military bases, as we were discussing as a possibility yesterday in our talk back, regardless of what the origin point of the disagreement is, we have encountered a very different set of people, especially in the tribal Afghans and especially in the fundamentalist Afghanis. So I will, as quickly as I can, describe this. There was a man, and you can see this video, I won't tell you where to find it, but it's on the web, of three women in burqas ululating and calling God is great, Allah Akbar, and three other men holding down a man, and then another party beheading the man with a knife. The party beheading the man with a knife was a 12-year-old boy. Now, at first blush, I was so struck by the evil at work there. I couldn't believe what I saw. A 12-year-old child. If, however, and I have to ask myself this question as well, and I would pose it to you also, If you're in a village where the slaughtering of animals is a routine daily occurrence in order to find your mate, where slitting the throats of goats and sheep is and twisting the heads of chickens in order to eat each night is a daily occurrence. And in an environment where the rights of manhood are defined so profoundly differently from the rights of manhood or womanhood in our culture, looked at from the inside of that child's mind, that child was being as heroic as Roland, as heroic as Hercules, as any great hero of the village. Such a disturbing notion. And so, as I said before, I have no answer to this. But I do know that there are so many contrasting ways of looking at the world that to give that child's action, that supernatural, all-permeating agency, is a strange question indeed, because his actions were derived from the very Godhead at work. In one interpretation. Time for some nice music. Does anyone have a thought about this that they'd be willing to share? Please, Mimi. Yes. Child, did you all hear that childhood itself is a modern construct? Certainly look at America. How long does it take for a modern American child to mature and go out into the world in economic independent these days? It's inching upward every year. I have three boys myself. And luckily, and just recently, having graduated from college as they have they been able to step out? Marrying at the age of 12 was an ordinary occurrence in medieval times, since the lifespan was not much more than 39 to 40. And I think that's a very interesting thing to say. Perhaps this child was already a man, and I misidentified him as a 12-year-old child. Perhaps I said he was a 12-year-old hunter, man of the village, strong, obedient. Does anyone else have a thought? Yes, please. Her comment was that there are, just as this morning's sermon filled everyone with a group feeling, that there are some religions who are very, very powerful in instilling not only a group feeling of belonging, but also of obedience. I spent some time last week reviewing five BBC videos called Hitler's Children. A very interesting topic. Five long, hour-long programs about how, beginning in the early 1930s, the National Socialists began to take children, boys and girls, to do very different sorts of programs away from their parents, they brought the boys to summer camps. For the first time, everyone was poor in Weimar Germany, early National Socialist Germany. The economy had been collapsed for many years. And so these little boys found themselves suddenly taken out to the countryside, given a chance to ride horses, to sail in boats, to rough and tumble play. And by the end of the decade, these Hitler youth who grew up told that the Führer was God and told that God did not exist any longer were willing to do what they did during the Second World War. Yes, there's something about group beliefs are extremely potent. There are some religions, however, that take the Hopi, they don't believe that even if you murder someone, you're evil. You are out of harmony. You're out of harmony with yourself. You're out of harmony with your community. You're out of harmony with nature. And so a kind of punishment that is meted out in our culture, all the way to the death penalty in the judicial system, is never even considered. But rather, people tend to attempt to find out what it is that is at the basis of this disharmony that has caused this behavior. And then they do their best to spiritually reincorporate that wandering soul. Well, firstly, the women were not weeping. They were praising the activity in no uncertain terms. It simply described that this is a video of a 12-year-old child in Afghanistan committing this act. Could have been a thief. There are plenty of ways to, quote, transgress in Islam, more so than there are in our culture. Plenty more ways. And so a transgression is much easier to trip over, I would imagine. Perhaps the person had been a thief, perhaps an adulterer, perhaps a murderer. Perhaps this person who was done away with was a scourge upon the community, and it was an act of goodness to rid the community of a wild person. Don't know. I wish I did. Please, ma'am. Very interesting. An interesting philosopher, psychologist, M. Scott Peck, has defined evil as a kind of militant self-righteousness. And perhaps it is that very thing that is a good working definition for it. What do you think? Yes, it goes immediately to the notion of how people perceive justice and whether an eye for an eye is a good operational concept or not. The French have been lopping off people's heads for quite some time. They simply use a guillotine. It's the very same activity, it's just a little bit quicker. And we've devised all manner of ways to put an end to a human life. It leads us into the whole question of capital punishment, justice for evil. Meet it out.
My father was talking one time about how we had to go to Afghanistan and Iraq because we have to fight terrorism. And I pointed out to him that for the people living in those countries, our presence there and things that we were actually feeling
Did you all hear her comment? She said that if you look at either the war in Afghanistan or the war in Iraq from the Afghani or Iraqi perspectives, people breaking down your door in the middle of the night, taking things, killing your family members could be construed readily as terrorism, as what we call terrorism over here. Sir. Indeed, the estimates for casualties of the Allies taking the home islands of Japan was 3 million. Sir.
A few months ago, there was on the nightly news, Western physicians had been invited to North Korea to perform cataract operations on people who had been blind for something that we cured very simply. And after they could see again, they stood before a portrait of their leader and bowed and thanked him for returning their sight.
Sleight of hand, misdirection, prestidigitation.
Yes, ma'am.
Her comment was that over a decade, she's watched the prison camp at Guantanamo Bay and has considered that to be an evil in itself and has felt powerless to do anything about it. I think if any of us can do anything about this, it is to answer the question in our minds that I posed to you at the beginning, before the story, at the outset, and that is evil something that we ourselves make? And we situationally assign to others when they are in opposition to us, or is it an all-permeating supernatural truth? And these actions that we take are simply the outer veiling of a much scarier thing. I have no answer to that, but I do hope that as soon as you leave the space today, you won't be troubled by it. This was by far the most difficult of the conversations that I hope to have this week. Tomorrow, we will explore something utterly different. We'll explore the nature of beauty. Is it mathematical? Or is it something inborn in our deepest selves? And is it outer or is it inner? And then the next day, we'll talk a bit about language and psycholinguistics and how language is being used nowadays to befuddle us as well as to charm us. And then lastly, we'll return to that notion at the end of the week, all these ideas notwithstanding, are we indeed free to choose between good and evil in our lives? Or are we simply in those swirls of chaotic clouds that have been predetermined long before? Thanks for being here. Take good care.